On Death, Sex, and Money, we feature interviews with you, our community of listeners, getting honest about uncomfortable things.
I developed an illness where it isn't safe for me to drive. A friend once said to me, sex is like air. You don't think about it until you're not getting enough. This is a similar sort of thing if you just replace sex with driving.
Listen to Death, Sex, and Money wherever you get podcasts.
Hello, listener. Dahlia Lithwick here, host of Amicus, that Slate's podcast on the courts and the law and democracy and the rule of law. This May, our team will be publishing a special project that we are calling How Originalism Ate the Law. This neutral and academic-sounding methodology of looking at the law is, in fact, anything but neutral. Originalism is to the conservative legal movement what peanut butter is to jelly. As we're going to show you over the course of this project, originalism has been both cover and calling for conservative justices and judges to radically overhaul the lives of millions of Americans. And while they claim to be the apolitical interpreters of the Constitution and its authors' intents, they have overturned Roe, radically expanded gun rights, and eviscerated voting rights. Across Slate.com and the Amicus podcast, we're going to be tackling questions like, where did originalism come from? Why has it taken over? Are progressive originalists really a thing? And am I allowed to have an opinion on originalism? Spoiler, the answer to that last question, you are. To celebrate the launch of this big project, we are running a special two-week-long free trial of Slate Plus on Apple Podcasts. As a member, you'll get exclusive episodes from How Originalism Ate the Law, plus ad-free listening to all of your favorite Slate podcasts. Join now by clicking Try Free at the top of the Amicus show page or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hello and welcome to the Slate Political Gabfest for July 7th, 2016, the 7 salty almonds, 6 pointed stars, 5 secret emails edition. I'm David Plotz of Atlas Obscura, that person attempting to laugh in the distance. Laughing wanly in the distance was Emily Bazelon of the New York Times Magazine. Hello, Emily.
Hello. I was affectionately laughing at your singing.
Not laughing, stone-faced in the studio with me, is resplendent John Dickerson of Face the Nation. Hello, John.
Hi.
I like the way you didn't even pretend that you could then have laughed. I like the way you won't even, like, give me a nod.
No,
give me
no.
Yeah. On this week's Gabfest, Hillary Clinton skirts disaster, but will the DOJ and FBI's decision not to prosecute her for her appalling email behavior still cost her? Then, is Donald Trump an anti-Semite as well as a racist? We will solve the case of the six-pointed star. Then, President Obama's nighttime habits are revealed in the New York Times. Do they reveal his strength as a politician or his weakness? Plus, we will have cocktail chatter, and in Slate Plus, the killing of Alton Sterling by Baton Rouge police, the killing of Philando Castile by police in Minnesota. Have we learned anything in the past year about the violence of police against African Americans? Has anything changed? If you are not yet a Slate Plus member, you can get it by going to slate.com/GabFestPlus. And don't forget, next week we have a live show here in Washington, D.C. at the Warner Theater. Tickets still available. There's still a few tickets available at slate.com/live. It's at 7 p.m. at the Warner Theater, slate.com/live. It's going to be a really great show. It's right before the conventions. We got a lot to talk about. We're going to have a lot to talk about. Look forward to seeing you there. In the late 1990s, it's sometimes seen that President Bill Clinton, that is, dodged catastrophe every day. He was not indicted over Whitewater, not indicted over Monica Lewinsky. He was impeached but not convicted for perjury. Perhaps his wife has some of that same voodoo in her soul. This week, she cleared the final obstacle between her and Donald Trump when the FBI's director, James Comey, a Republican, announced that the FBI would recommend that recommend to the Justice Department that she and her aides not be indicted for their incredibly careless, stupid email handling while she was at the State Department. On Wednesday, Attorney General Loretta Lynch confirmed that DOJ would indeed not indict her or her aides, effectively closing the case, at least at DOJ headquarters. Emily, what did Comey and the FBI find, and how vindicating or not was it for Clinton?
Comey and the FBI found that there were emails that were sent and received by Hillary Clinton on her private email server that had top secret and secret and confidential information. So this contradicted her statement that nothing classified ever passed over this private email thing she had going on. And he basically said that he wasn't going to indict her because he didn't think she was intentionally trying to misuse the government's secrets or spread information. He said it would be unprecedented for an official to be indicted merely for this extreme carelessness. And that was interesting and instantly got a lot of criticism from Clinton's political opponents, because the statute itself calls for gross negligence. It doesn't call for criminal intent. And so Comey was kind of reading into Congress's intent in passing this law a higher standard for an indictment and for deciding that someone should be prosecuted for a crime. And that's a pretty standard move for prosecutors to make in a situation like this. But it does contradict the text of the law itself in a way that was interesting. And then there was just this really unusual long description of all of the facts of a case in which the FBI had decided to recommend against a prosecution. I couldn't remember ever listening to a law enforcement official give this kind of detail when you're deciding not to recommend in favor of charging with a crime. So that was a, I thought, fascinating window into the FBI's own process. It was not good for Hillary Clinton because it provided all kinds of details about how she was essentially misusing this email server and, you know, makes her seem paranoid and high-handed, which we already knew. But now we have the facts that show that, you know, she really was doing things she wasn't supposed to do. Now, it also seemed like there was really no harm. So then the question is it no harm, no foul?
But Emily, just on this intent question, she certainly seems to have been grossly negligent in how she handled this information. I doubt she intended to use this to share classified information. She certainly intended to use this to skirt government technology policies and intended to use it to skirt, say, FOIA. There was a lot of intent in what she was doing, even right. if it wasn't necessarily intent right. to reveal classified information.
Right. And that's why Comey's laying out all of these facts then raises these questions. Why hold the government in deciding to prosecute her to this higher standard? Why shouldn't, if the statute says gross negligence and he made a case for gross negligence, then why not indict? And the reason is that prosecutors have an enormous amount of discretion. Now, Comey himself isn't a prosecutor. The prosecutorial discretion part is still up to the Department of Justice. But essentially, he was talking about a judgment call and substituting his own ideas and I suppose the rest of the FBI's and maybe DOJ. I mean, well, DOJ, like I said, was separate, but you can imagine the Justice Department will go along with this idea that there is this higher standard of criminal intent. That is tricky. I really think the only way to understand this is that from what we know, the actual confidential and top secret information that got shared was not actually the kind of state secret that could have done damage to the government. And so there's this funny way, I think, in which what's really at issue here is that the impact of what she did was negligible in terms of actually hurting the country. And somehow that standard has been imputed into this gross negligence idea.
Do we really know that what she had was the confidential stuff that was marked confidential and that was confidential at the time, which was one of the disclosures, was inconsequential? Because he said some of it was at the highest levels.
Well, there's an interesting Fred Kaplan piece about this where Fred makes a pretty good case saying that this is essentially about drone strikes, CIA drone strikes, which were classified as, I guess, confidential or secret, even though the same strikes being carried out by DOD were not. And they've been reported in the media. So that's most of it. And then
he assumes is most of it.
Well, I didn't understand. Well, no, but I didn't understand. But then he said the other one is that a communication about the president of Malawi Which it's hard to imagine that I've been to Malawi. It's a great country, but it's hard to imagine the communication president of Malawi could be.
I don't think we know.
I didn't understand how he knew that. How Fred knew that.
I don't think we know. Anyway. I don't think we know. So here.
That was reported not just by Fred, right? The New York Times had the same set of assumptions.
Yeah, but they're assumptions.
But yes, I agree, John, that if you read
their assumptions, yes, they're guesses.
Yes, I agree.
So.
They seemed like well-educated guesses, but guesses nonetheless.
I think to your point, David, the difference between intents in the intent that I think the statute goes to is whether you had an intent to specifically directed at this classified stuff. The intent that she had that you described, which was to get around the system, which was to protect her privacy, she had super intent on that, but it was
right.
in a separate channel.
Right.
But can we just? The real damage here is that he completely shredded a half a dozen or more claims that Hillary Clinton has made in this political campaign about her server. She said she didn't send anything that was classified in any form. He said that wasn't true. There were over 100 such items. Regardless of what they were about, they were classified. Comey said she should have known that and everybody participating in it should have known it, whether it had the markings or not on that. He said that
and a few of them did have the markings,
right,
too.
Right. So she said that in several interviews, including one with me, she said, you know, we wouldn't have even bumped up against anything that would even be remotely considered problematic because we, and particularly she named Jake Sullivan, knew exactly how to handle this kind of information. Comey said, no, that wasn't true. They were extremely careless about how to handle this information. The security of the server was basically totally open. Less secure than Gmail, less secure than any of the private servers she might have used or private systems she might have used if she hadn't created her own special server. He described an extremely complicated system of multiple servers and multiple devices, which contradicts her claim that this was about convenience, a contradiction that had already been exposed by the State Department's Inspector General, which surfaced an email in which she's talking about her privacy and not her convenience. Of course, privacy makes perfect sense if you're a public figure like her. The only problem is that she has claimed publicly that this whole rigmarole was created out of convenience. So there's that contradiction. Her campaign said that her lawyers read every single email that they deleted. Comey said, no, that's not true. They basically searched through the emails with some keywords to find anything that might be work-related, sent those things that were work-related to the State Department, and then deleted everything else. The bias there being the total reverse of the way the system is supposed to work. The bias is supposed to be on retention because these are people that are employed by the voters, and therefore everything they do should be subject to some kind of review and should be captured first and then weeded out. She turned that totally upside down and on its head. She said they deleted no work emails. He said there were plenty of work emails that were deleted, some of which they could recover after this incredibly laborious, time-consuming, painstaking, and expensive process of trying to recover them from her servers that her lawyers tried to wipe. So there were emails there that were work-related that she didn't turn over, which is another contradiction of something that she's said repeatedly. And we know from the Inspector General that despite the fact that the Clinton campaign said that she operated within the spirit and the letter of the law, that she did not operate within the spirit and the letter of the law. That's a lot of stuff, not just about stuff that happened when she was first brought into the office, but contradiction of repeated claims she's made in the course of this campaign.
Do you think, John, as a political matter, that this is a pulled muscle or is it an amputation? Like,
well,
is this a permanent injury to her, or is this just a temporary thing, or she bears a hit but ultimately she recovers?
I think normally it would be a real blow, but she's running against a candidate who has created new excellence in saying things that either contradicting himself or saying things that are factually inaccurate and easily verifiably factually inaccurate. You know, she's running against somebody who has his own trust issues. And what it comes down to for voters is which of the, A, did the distrust matter to you as a voter? And B, the two kinds of trust are A, what do you do when no one's looking? Which is to say, what do you do when nobody's looking and you set up your own server? And B, what do you do when everyone's looking and you have to decide whether the person is telling you the truth or not. She, whether it has a long term damage, who knows? Because we are in this crazy race. If she were running against Marco Rubio, it would have a huge damage.
Emily, do you think, as the general consensus seems to be, that the Republicans botched this response because they they focused on the non-indictment rather than focusing on the incredible findings that Comey had, and that by getting indignant at Comey and the FBI and the AG, they missed the opportunity to really pound on what Comey did say, and also that Trump, of course, distracted everybody with his usual mishigas.
Which, just to give people the usual mishigas, included saying that Saddam Hussein, though he was a bad guy, was good at killing terrorists, which is also factually inaccurate. He supported terrorists.
Yes, I did think they botched the response. The obvious line was that Comey thoroughly discredited Hillary Clinton, and to lay out the brief that John just laid out, which shows her saying things that turned out to be wrong could otherwise be characterized as lying. It seemed like that was such an obvious, huge gift that Comey gave them. And so then to turn this into the system is rigged because she's not being indicted, it just seemed like a real lost opportunity to me.
How should she spin this, John? Should she spin this as victory? Should she say nothing? Should she quietly apologize and move on?
Tried to spin, the several times they said the issue has been resolved and she apologizes. So that's obviously silly. The issue hasn't been resolved. I mean, the legal issue has been resolved, but the central issue for voters who don't know, like, statute schmatute, is what the candidate is telling me about the way they behaved in a situation that's not too terribly different from the kinds of situations we all expect them to encounter as president. Were they telling me the truth? That's not been resolved. I think the only way it gets resolved is through answering the questions. The problem is the questions are unanswerable because the statements were made and then they were contradicted by, not by some Republican hack, but by the Inspector General of the State Department and the Director of the FBI. Like, and the Director of the FBI, whose authority you are validating by saying the issue has been resolved. In other words, he has the authority and we believe in that authority when we want it to work for us, which is to say, nothing to see here, issue resolved, let's move on. You can't then say, oh, well, all the other stuff he said lacks value and weight. It just, like, so I think the way she gets around it is just talks about stuff that people that voters, she's been talking about college education and college costs this week, and you talk about Donald Trump and you talk about the things people care about in their daily lives and hope that it just kind of, you can grind it out through to November, I guess.
I think that's right. I mean, the other thing I keep balking over is that one tries to think, okay, well, so when she said all those things, we were super careful, no classified information, blah, blah. Was she just deliberately lying and obfuscating? Or did she just imagine that, or did she not really know? And did she just imagine that she wasn't ever going to get caught in that lie because they would never investigate this thoroughly? None of those are appetizing options, right? It's really hard to know what to make of those statements she made that doesn't seem pretty damning.
What is her explanation? What did they say they were doing with the classified stuff? Because obviously she was clearly going to get lots of classified material. And so they made a plan that we don't want to get the classified material here. So what did they do? It's just coming to her on paper?
Right. It came to her on paper. There was an email that was found in one of the investigations in which she asked Jake Sullivan to basically strip the headers and strip the classifying information, which she defended herself by saying, don't misinterpret that email, which seems to be basically her giving guidance on how to get around the classification and suggests a facility with getting around the classification that's really well practiced, right? She wasn't unfamiliar with it as she was unfamiliar with so many other things, which we know from the emails. I mean, unfamiliar with just technological things. She seemed pretty facile at this. So her argument was, no, I wasn't doing that. I was trying to get the actual information, sometimes real useful information, which she needs to do her job, is kind of laced within stuff that is either classified or is like quote unquote classified, the drone stuff being a good example. Right. It's classified or it has some level of classification, but it's appearing in the New York Times. So her argument was, what I was asking him to do is send me the useful stuff in this report, right, and the not classified stuff. And the classified stuff was done through the normal, like it was either on paper or verbal or...
I mean, my suspicion is that they really intended to keep the classified stuff away from the server. They knew enough to do that. And that just you slip up, people right. send stuff. There's a very small, I mean, 100 emails is a pretty small number when you think about how much classified material much she must see.
Right.
And they just slipped up occasionally. But that was the intent.
But what do you do about the fact that she was obviously, I mean, yes, she has privacy concerns. She has reason to have privacy concerns. But she was avoiding FOIA. She was deliberately.
It's just a total disgrace. Okay. It's a complete disgrace. It's a horror. And the security, the absence of security, the fact that they were hackable. It's shocking.
And the fact she was using it in countries. How did Comey put it? Yeah. Like
all over the world.
Well, all over the world, including countries that were actively.
I'm sure in China, they were just like, "Thank you."
This gift you brought to us.
Exactly. We love your BlackBerry.
When he said, well, Secretary you know, Clinton. She may not have been, you know, her email may not have been accessed by a hostile actor. You start thinking like, well, how could it have not been? How lucky.
Well, that's what he said we wouldn't know even if it were. And Adam Schiff on Face the Nation on Sunday, basically, that the top Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee said it probably was hacked based on what we know. I mean, if the Russians were hacking into the DNC to get the information the DNC had, they weren't going to be like, that sounds, if they've gotten to that, you're pretty sure that there are higher targets on the list, which would have included the Secretary of State.
Let's close on this. The most interesting thing I read about this week was Glenn Greenwald's column.
Yeah, that was interesting.
It was a very scathing, brilliant column arguing essentially that it is really rich for Hillary Clinton to be left alone when this administration has been absolutely ruthless and vicious about enforcing secrecy provisions for the little people. And Greenwald points out, I think with just complete accuracy, that had a regular State Department staffer set up a private server and stored classified emails on that private server, they would be doing hard time. They would be in a federal prison somewhere, no doubt. They would have the conclusion that we should make about this. The conclusion that I would make is not necessarily that Hillary Clinton should have gone to jail. It's that there is a problem with how we're treating secrecy in this administration, in the city, and it's full of hypocrisy. And Greenwald says, like, the hypocrisy is we're protecting powerful people who do things. But in general, I think it's a mess. Emily, what do you think about this?
Yes, I thought it was a really compelling column. He brought up Chelsea Manning, who leaked to WikiLeaks and is doing a lot of hard time. And, you know, look, those were a lot of real secrets that got revealed. And so I think if you don't think Clinton's use of this email server was a big deal, and this is Fred Kaplan's position, you're looking at the effect that it actually had. It appears that she sort of skated through this. I mean, you know, no great state secret, as far as we know, did escape through this email. And so, you know, it's like, okay, nothing to look at. Let's not pay attention here. But she broke all these rules and she's being held to, you know, she's getting away with it in a way that other people, including Chelsea Manning, obviously did not.
And also just, there is the, like, stuff she said in real time in the campaign that's not turned out to be true. All of the things that are being displayed in a campaign are not useful in evaluating whether and how they're going to behave as a president. But some of the things are. And so there's not only the things that turned out to not be true that she said out loud, but there is the troubling pattern over time about this kind of skating the rules and creating it and feeling like different rules apply to you.
And the self-inflicted wound. Oh, it's so frustrating. Like watching someone just take herself down for no good reason. For what? So that like she could write emails about Chelsea's wedding and her own yoga classes without worrying about FOIA. There's something so frustrating about that part of it.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th only on Hulu. This week in the Hieronymus Bosch-like spectacle that is the Donald Trump campaign, we had Donald Trump, as previously mentioned, praising Saddam Hussein. But then we also had this crazy scandal erupting over the tweeting of an image depicting corrupt Hillary Clinton. That image, which indicated that she was financially untrustworthy and greedy, contained a six-pointed red star. Further indignant investigation revealed that that image had originated with a white supremacist, anti-Semitic Twitter user. Some slash many people turned up their outrage machine to the full 11 to indict Trump for anti-Semitism. So what part of the scandal did I not explain or miss, John?
Well, you didn't put
the key element.
I think you left out a key element of the visual, which is that the six-pointed star, which is the Star of David, a Jewish star, was on top of a pile of money, which is a stereotype about Jews. Their greed, their, you know, banking history. I think that's key to seeing the anti-Semitism there.
Yeah. Okay. John, anything else I missed?
You've accurately, I think, conveyed the state of things.
Okay. So I think there are two issues here. The first is this image alone anti-Semitic? And then the second is the origin of it, like the fact of where it came from, the problem. To me, like, who cares that there's a star? Hillary Clinton is not Jewish. She's not a Jewish candidate. And absent, you know, independent of where it turned out to come from, it has many meanings of the world. And it just seemed to me that the outrage about this as subtext, when you consider what the obvious actual text of Donald Trump is about Mexicans, about Muslims, about African Americans and crime, like the kind of level of vitriol that rose instantly over that thing seemed to me really out of whack, out of proportion with what the misdeed is.
And then when you learned that it came from a white supremacist, you know, Twitter user and had been on white supremacist site, did that change your sense of it? Or, and what about the pile of money? Did you not care about that either?
I don't care. I don't. So what? What do you mean about the pile of money? Hillary Clinton is somebody who buck rakes like crazy from Goldman Sachs. And like, it's perfectly legitimate to criticize her for taking tons of money for the Clinton Foundation for herself. And a pile of money is a good representation of it. And a star is a perfectly fine image. And it's like the fact that it comes from an anti-Semitic, you know, dirtbag is a problem, because that means that the Trump campaign is basically getting their information there.
Right.
But in itself, like before that we knew that part of it, it just doesn't seem like relevant. She's not Jewish. It doesn't. She's not.
Wow. Like, I feel like having a hyper rational response to this, which I have to say I did not have. I am generally not in favor of going to look for anti-Semitism in America, because I don't think
it's... And now she says, and now goes to look
exactly.
for anti-Semitism.
Exactly.
I don't
think it's our country's biggest
go
problem.
Look for it.
So I'm there that far with you. I'm sort of was reluctant to see this here. But I gotta say, like, you know, you see a Jewish star on top of a lot of money. I think that the stereotypes that that this image was playing into are right there at the surface. There, it's not very hard to make those connections. And the idea that, okay, because Hillary herself isn't Jewish and Trump's campaign purportedly intended this to have a different message about her corruption, and that sort of erases all of the history that these noxious stereotypes tap into, that seems crazy to me. Like, I feel like when you wrap Jewish images up in greed and dollar signs, you are tapping right into this incredibly virulent stereotype that has caused an enormous amount of harm to the Jewish people. And so I did take umbrage.
You take umbrage even independent of where you thought the origin was.
Well, it's
you think
hard for me to say, because when I learned about it, there was an argument going on, like, where did this come from? You know, did they find it themselves? But to me, I was so unsurprised, given Trump's history of following some of these alt-right or white supremacist or white genocide people on Twitter and using things that they had tweeted out in other contexts. I assumed that seemed so typical that it was going to have that origin. And so it was all just like of a piece to me. I didn't really experience it separately.
Also, he's to use the stereotypes associated with one race or religion on somebody who's not of that race or religion is a thing that's done, even if they're not. I mean, that's a way to
smear her.
Smear her. I mean, so the fact that she isn't one, that I think that is hyper rationalism. Although I generally
As a Jew, I looked at that before. It took me several days for me to understand what people. I literally did not understand why people were upset. It took me days to actually comprehend
it.
I honestly
didn't. Walls and dollar signs. I mean, come on, David. Like, that's
she's not Jewish.
So what? Right.
And that is that's not. I mean, if she was in blackface, you would think, well, she's not an African American.
Right, or if she was being shown.
When they did that. So but remember, that was done with Joe Lieberman in his Senate race. Somebody did a, like a, I don't know, a Photoshop and had him in blackface.
But I guess I guess I don't think that that star, it's a, that star, you know, as a yellow star on someone's, you know, on an armband, I get that. As a blue star, that the blue, is the blue star that is used on the flag of Israel, right? I see it, but it's like a random red 6-pointed star. I see 6-pointed stars like all around the world. And the other part of it is that it doesn't, Donald Trump does seem to me to be a bigot who is anti-Muslim. He's anti-black. He's anti-Hispanic and racist in all those ways. He actually doesn't read to me as anti-Semitic.
No, like, but that, Josh that Marshall had that, a really
and,
good...
and so. Right. Josh Marshall, go ahead.
Well, he had a really good line on this. He talked about Trump's attitude toward Jews as this kind of, to me, warped philo-Semitism, where you pretend you have this great affection, right? Years ago, Trump said something about how he wanted people with yarmulkes to be managing his money. And he intended that, one imagines, as a compliment. Like, oh, good, Jews, they're so good at money. But like, Jews being good at money has caused a lot of damage in throughout history and continues to. And so that kind of, you know, supposedly positive stereotype is a big problem. And it doesn't make...
It is not a big problem.
Yes, it is.
It's not a big...
It is a big problem.
It's a little problem.
Fine.
It's a little problem.
In the world, it is... Given lots
it's a
of
tiny,
other problems,
tiny little problem. Philo-Semitism, which associates Jews with you know earning money and controlling the media, is a really like in a is a very small problem compared to everything else that Donald Trump represents.
Well, I look. I mean, I agree with you when we
and
have
it's the unarmed... Jewish and the Jews in the media who like me and you, Emily, who get so worked up over this about this, which is. As I would say, is like it's not that there's nothing to it because the origins are incredibly troubling. It's that it's so small compared to everything else that he does.
Yeah, but it's also of a piece with everything else, right?
Well, that's the other thing is
like, it's all of these groups. He tarnishes people. He traffics in stereotypes and group characterizations, and Jews happen to be a group for whom there are both positive and negative stereotypes. I don't know. To me, it's all cringeworthy and problematic. And I don't think it's the teeniest, tiniest problem when you see it as part of this tapestry of Trump's bigotry.
That's the challenge, is that there are, you know, there was the slow, let's step back and look at the way other Republicans and people in the party see this. There was this slow, clumsy non-response to when Jake Tapper asked him about white supremacists and David Duke. There is the retweeting of various white supremacists at various different times. There's the white supremacist who was a delegate in California. Like in their single, you know, if there were one of them, fine. But the fact that there are so many of them is a problem, if for no other reason than every other Republican thinks, geez, he's hanging out in these quarters that this is not a neighborhood you should be in. It should not be an issue that you are retweeting or using imagery from a white supremacist, because you're not even near that. Not because it's politically incorrect, but because you find that kind of behavior and people who talk like that to be totally reprehensible and contrary to what you believe in your bones, right? It's like you're not like watching pornography with your kids. It's so therefore it's unlikely that anything that from a pornographic website is going to get passed on, because it just ain't something you do.
Donald Trump watched porn with his kids.
So that's the thing that makes politicians in his party and people just like shocked by this. And then I think the other thing that is interesting to watch is that on Wednesday night he defended the tweet, said he shouldn't have deleted it, and said this was all like, you know, but like media and Democrats attacking him. What's interesting there is that Republicans, another thing that worries them is that basically, given the Clinton email scandal and all the legitimate questions raised by it, even if he felt put upon by the press and his critics on this issue, that he should have basically not talked about it. it's like, it doesn't matter. You're winning the news cycles repeatedly when officials are calling out Hillary Clinton for her not telling the truth. And so yet he cannot resist. And that cannot resist the feeling about personal slights is a lack of control. And it's been repeated. And the question is, what does that look like when he's president? What does that look like when there are a lot of more important things to deal with? Is his inability to let some of these slights pass, what will that mean? What's curious about Donald Trump is he gets a lot of slights. People say a lot of mean things about him. Some he chooses to defend well past the point where he should, and some he doesn't, don't bother him at all. And I don't know what the triggering mechanism is.
Me neither, but I have to say I find it totally fascinating. So I was like fast forwarding through that endless speech on Wednesday night, and it's like your grumpy grandpa having to share with you every single way in which he's been aggrieved during the week, right? I mean, it reminds me of myself when I feel like I'm under attack and I have to like vent at the end of the day to my poor husband, like, and then this unfair thing happened and this person, the idea that someone would use a huge crowd and a television audience to kind of deal with their own psychology of like working out how someone insulted them in ways that, your best friend maybe, or your spouse has to hear that stuff, but the rest of the world really doesn't. It's so undignified, and yet he's obsessed with it.
I just want to go back to Josh Marshall's piece. Emily, you touched on it. I thought it was a really great piece for a bunch of reasons. And what you talk about the philo-Semitic part of it. I thought Josh's real insight was he was saying that Trump essentially has no belief system himself, that he hones in, he responds to affirmation. And this is a salesman psychology, that salesmen are always looking for what is it that's moving the person they're trying to sell to. What is it the audience that you have is responding to? And it becomes a reinforcing cycle because you see the audience responding to something, so you double down on it. And what has happened to Trump is that he read that his audience was responding to anger and sort of the more bigoted, racist, rageful parts of it. And he took on more of that. And I don't actually think it represents any actual belief system on his part. I think it is that where he saw opportunity, because people, that is where the greatest emotional response was coming. And in a way, it's much more dangerous than an actual belief system.
It's also a really good explanation for why he can't broaden his appeal. Because if the emotional response that he craves is coming from his most ardent supporters, and those people are mixed up with the alt-right and, are more on the fringe, then it becomes very difficult to moderate and stick to your, boring old teleprompter talking points.
Can we talk for one second about this phrase, the alt-right, which it irritates me because I always associate alt with like, ooh, indie, that great band with tattoos. And alt-right just means like just some racist dirtbags who are good on Twitter. Okay.
All right.
I just said that. Right. You guys have nothing else.
You drove a stake through the heart of that phrase.
Okay. Last bit on this to maybe preview next week. It's a slightly different subject. In his crazy speech on Wednesday night, Trump did tease Newt Gingrich as his possible VEEP. Should we take anything from that? He said that Newt would do great in the debates.
Yeah. So I have both a general and a specific aversion to the parlor game, which Trump is using, and successfully he had Bob Corker out with him on the stump, Newt Gingrich, he went to go meet with Mike Pence. He's using one of the weaknesses in our coverage of these campaigns, which is the endless obsession with the players and who might be VEEP and who might not be VEEP. So I think what's interesting is what it tells us about him. And one thing that it does, that having said all of that high horse crap, one thing that is interesting, though, about the people who are on the list and who are taking themselves off the list is I had a conversation with somebody who was talking to one of the people who was kind of on the list, was thinking about being on the list. If you look at the two categories, there are those camp politicians who have future ambitions in the party and electoral politics. So that would be Mike Pence, Indiana governor, Tom Cotton, senator from Arkansas, Corker from Tennessee, senator Joni Ernst from Iowa. All those people want to continue on in the party. They have all taken themselves off the list that they were maybe on. Gingrich and Christie are kind of done. Ed O'Keefe made this point from the Washington Post. Their careers have hit a ceiling, and they will continue to have – that's fine. They'll give speeches. Life is not over for them, but they are not planning to have a future. And so hitching themselves to Donald Trump has less risk associated with it. But the person who was advising one of these possible candidates was explaining something to me, or reminding me of something that I've forgotten, which is when you sign up for a campaign, usually what happens is there's an apparatus to take care of the vice president. And the Trump campaign has been successful in being a non-traditional campaign, but there are certain things that you kind of still have to do. And one of them is take care of your vice president. And the reason you do that is that the vice president like can't be out there just hanging out on their own, off message, not advising, not knowing what the candidate's doing, because there aren't a lot of opportunities for the candidate and the vice president to talk. They almost never do during a campaign. So anybody who signs up to be the number two for Donald Trump will face all the challenges we're aware of, but will have none of the support system to keep them okay, which means if they are worried about their own political viability after the race is over, there are more opportunities where they're going to think, yeesh, I'm going to be out there and the whistling wind of chance will be howling around me and I'm not going to have a backup system because the campaign is basically all about Donald Trump and is also just basically short-staffed and non-traditional. So I'm not going to have a very good like support system, and that's going to make it even more chaotic. And that, for me, really explained why those who are ambitious are not going to sign up. But I think Trump could also pick, you know, there might be a couple of military figures that he could pick, and that we're making the parallel with Wallace in 68, who picked Curtis LeMay as his number two. Interesting. And I think it's going to be fascinating about what it tells us about Donald Trump and also what it means for the next several months of the two of them trying to kind of stay on the same page.
Oh my God!
What a fun job! Trump, the line will
Donald
be
Trump
long.
Trump picks the ghost of Curtis LeMay.
Politics has never been stranger or more online, which is why the politics team at Wired is making a new show, Wired Politics Lab. It's all about how to navigate the endless stream of news and information and what to look out for. Each week on the show, we'll dig into far-right platforms, AI chatbots, influencer campaigns, and so much more. Wired Politics Lab launches Thursday, April 11th. Follow the show wherever you get your podcasts.
A New York Times story fascinated students of politics and presidents this week. The story detailed President Obama's nighttime routine. It seems that early in his presidency, Obama would, after having dinner with his family, he would play pool with Sam Cass, who was one of the White House chefs and a family friend. And then he'd put his daughters to bed and then he might do some work. Now that his daughters have grown up, Cass is gone. He has a routine, or claims, apparently, the story claims he has a routine where he holds up in the treaty room, reads documents, watches ESPN, plays words with friends, and snacks on 7 lightly salted almonds, not 6 and not 8, but 7, and then goes to bed quite late. He doesn't appear to be hanging out much with Michelle in these evenings, not with his kids. He doesn't appear to be, in the way that Bill Clinton was, constantly on the phone with people. So, John, you are the world's greatest living student of both presidents and time spending
and life hacking. Yeah.
And what did this story tell you about President Obama? What did you learn from it that you didn't know?
The first thing that hit me is I just saw a talk by Charles Duhigg about productivity and why people succeed and how they succeed. And he talked about the cognitive space you need where you can do deep thinking, and that everybody who is successful in a world of constant attention attacks finds a time where they can do deep thinking. And we know from study after study that focused work allows us to be the most creative and most productive, and productive not in terms of really being able to solve or create something great. So that was the first reaction I had, which is Bill Clinton used to set aside time. Let's avoid the obligatory jokes. Used to have on his calendar thinking time, like blocks of time where people weren't interrupting him, so he could work on whatever project it was that was most important to him. So that felt like that's what this was. The other thing too is that when you are president, every moment is being stolen from you. You can't take a walk. You can't like peer out a window without either interruption or being late for the next event. Your day is spent in a vice all day long, like just thousands of like little niggling little things constantly. And then there's the huge stuff that comes. No decision is small when it gets to the president. And so there's a lot on your mind, which makes each individual interruption more irritating. Because let's say you're trying to focus on a big decision you have to make, but you're being like, suddenly you're now having to like stand out with the Denver Broncos and hold up a jersey and celebrate their Super Bowl win, or you've got to, you know, go pardon a turkey. And so it doesn't surprise me at all that he or any president would want to, this is why like the golf and the brush clearing and all of that stuff, we should force presidents to do that, not criticize them for going off to Crawford or for going to play golf. It's ridiculous given what their days are like and what we demand from them in the pantomimes of the office, which is to say lots of vigorous action in response to things that don't have an immediate vigorous action response, but we demand it anyway. And so given all of the psychological and physical contortions we require from presidents, the finding a sanctuary in the day makes sense. And in the evening when nobody's around and nobody's there to interrupt you and everybody's gone to bed, that, of course, must feel like a blessed time where you just can regain some sense of yourself and actually maybe get some work done. I don't see how he does, though, on so little sleep. The job's – I would just think you'd need more – I think you'd need like Bush-level sleep, 8 hours a day constantly just to stay on focus.
The part I didn't understand is how you could watch ESPN for hours and hours every night.
But he's not ESPN really watching it. It sounded like it was in on the background unless there was like a really good game going on.
I guess that's true. My favorite detail is that he works in the treaty room under a picture of Ulysses S. Grant.
Your favorite
My
president.
Favorite American. Yeah. So that seemed good.
I think it's just really important for people to have a part of the day that they get to spend the way they want to spend. So I don't care what the president's doing. I agree with John that there should be this zone that is personal and has just like relaxation in it. And my favorite details was that he was playing words with friends and it's like goofing off a little, just having a some kind of light brain activity that feels like it's not accomplishing anything. Or I guess a game like that, you are sort of accomplishing something, but it's meaningless.
There was an article in Vanity Fair a couple of years ago, which our Resolute intern Kevin pointed us to, which also it took some of the same data set around President Obama and his what he likes to do at leisure and spun it very differently. It took the case that his lack of socializing, his non-Clintonian quality of Clinton, who always wanted social input and social interaction, and that was that kind of behavior, while pathological, also served to lubricate his political life. And that Obama, by being so interior at heart, not cultivating these relationships with political allies or enemies, had missed an opportunity, and that this was a problem for him.
This is so tedious to me, because essentially it's blaming Obama for recharging by himself, which is an introvert quality. And sure, maybe it'd be, I mean, such a refrain in Washington that if he was better at glad handing, somehow everything would be different. But it seems to me that if there was an extreme pathological version of this on the other side, it was Bill Clinton in his extreme extrovert self that he could never turn off.
But also it's, as Bill Clinton would say, it's false choice. You can be a great glad-handing politician who does all the stuff you need to do in politics during the day and still require the recharging and the contemplative time later at night, as Duhigg points out. That's how successful people do it. And Bill Clinton's requirement that he have that alone time to think was not in contradiction or contravention or any other word I can come up with of his more glad-handing side. Obama's does have a problem with lacking the political instinct that would come, as Chuck Schumer put it, from like climbing the greasy pole of politics. Like if you've done it your whole career, you have a kind of second nature sense, which isn't so much the misunderstanding about glad handing is that it's all about like go have drinks and sit down and have you know, dinner with them. What the glad handing instinct gives you is a sense of people's needs, both to be pressured, to be scratched, to be loved, to be all those little buttons. You know how to push those buttons. And you don't have to go do them yourself a lot of time. A lot of time you just send to some minion and say, like, go, you know, go make sure that so-and-so is okay. There's a great memo that James Baker wrote during the 1976 fight between Ford and Reagan, in which he outlines the delegate sucking up effort that was required because there were a number of uncommitted delegates who were up in the air about which of the two candidates they were going to go to. And he says basically in the memo, the thing that politicians hate is to not know what's going on and to not feel loved. So he created this regimen of just constant affirmation and affection. Ford didn't have to do any of that stuff. It was all being done for him. And that's the thing that a politician, that a person who's been in politics a long time knows how to do. That's a totally separate issue from whether you have this contemplative time. So I think, having not read the Vanity Fair piece, I'm not maybe being fair to it, but I think these two things are kind of totally separate.
My one thing I was struck by as I read the story is that I actually didn't believe that this was how President Obama spent most of his evenings.
You don't believe in those 7 lightly salted almonds? I think this, my God.
This represents one form of evening that he spends. That he doesn't do this every evening, that he is probably with his wife more than this suggests he is with his wife. I felt like that this was trying to universalize something, which is a thing that he does, you know, like a couple times a week when there's a good game on. And John, why are you nodding?
I think you're right. Well, and we may be the ones making the mistake here, which is like, you know, this is what he does some number of nights, and it's a routine. You know, like I like to think I work out in the morning. I probably do it only like once or twice a week.
Right.
So, but to the extent it's a routine in the morning, the rest of the days are defined by like happenstance.
Right.
So it's a routine. Like, what defines a routine, I guess, is what I'm saying.
When I think like if someone said, oh, I'm going to write about David Plotz's nighttime routine, I would say, oh, yeah, you know, sure. We have dinner and hang out, watch some TV, kids to bed, Hannah and I, you know, sit on the couch and work and then, you know, watch an HBO show or something. But that actually happens once a week. It doesn't happen 6 nights a week. And I was also struck, and you know, everyone's marriage is a foreign country, so you never should make assumptions about anyone else's marriage or what it means. But it was weird to me how little Michelle Obama was in the story. Like that also rung false to me, because my sense is that they are a couple that is a very much a married couple, and the fact that as portrayed, they have dinner, but then they're not together, and then she goes to bed early.
Well, this whole thing of going to bed separately, this is a real dividing line between couples, I think, because I personally cannot imagine that. It would change everything about my evenings and my
marriage. So with you. Totally with
you.
Wait,
what?
Yeah. I'll tell you.
I always go to bed with Hannah.
Right.
Like 90,
but
95%
you and Anne go
time.
To bed at different times, right, John?
Totally, yeah.
Yeah.
For
so
work.
Sometimes
I have to go to bed earlier. It's been this way since college that I stay up and do work. That's almost always the way. That's interesting. You go to bed at the same time.
Always.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
Does that mean you go to bed and read, or the lights are out at the same time?
No, the lights are out usually. At the same time. Both. It means
wow.
Both. Yeah.
Wow. That's really interesting. I wonder if that's a
You get up at the same time?
No, I'm always up earlier.
So basically you're saying she's a slug of bed. She's a lazy
no, no,
bone.
She's is healthier. That's the answer.
She's healthy.
She's lazy.
No,
why
she's
are you saying that
healthier.
She's lazy?
Oh, please.
Why would you say
that's
that, John?
That's ridiculous.
She's much healthier.
David, stop it.
She's far healthier.
That is so weird. Hannah and I would 95% of the time sleep at the same time, read at the same time, sleep at the same time, wake up at the same time.
Wow. Yeah. Right. I really think this is a dividing line. Someone should do a whole story about this.
Well, I guess the question is, yeah, and how big are the two shares of the pie? Like,
right.
Am I in the vast minority, or
that'd be great to know.
And does it and because in the Obama case, it seems like David, you're making there's a like a little whiff of judgment of the fact that they are out of sync.
Yeah, that's right. You heard the judgment, which is totally wrong. Right. It's totally wrong. It's not fair. But you read it correctly, John.
Also, where were the kids? The kids were also strangely absent from this whole narrative, which was one of the reasons I didn't think it was every night.
Wait, can we?
I don't know. Wouldn't teenage kids be absent from the parent? Like, whatever. They don't want to be with their parents.
Let's set up a survey. We're going to do a survey. Let's do a survey. Put on Facebook if you go to bed at the same time as your couple, if you're in a couple.
And if you're in the same space as your children in the evening. If they're teenagers, no, they are probably not talking to you the entire time. But are they like in your sight.
And where is the mother-in-law? And where's the dog? Good question. The dog. Why is the dog?
You got to imagine the dog's with him.
That would have been like a very. Oh my God, did they have that detail? Not,
yeah, exactly. No, I knew. Okay. I know. You know, and I wonder, do they walk their dog at the end of the night?
I don't know. Maybe the girls have to do that. Jocelyn is sending me like, wrap this up, but I don't want to. But we will wrap it up. Okay.
Jocelyn's taking pity on our one remaining listener.
Hey, Jon Favreau here. There's no shortage of political takes in 2024, but quantity doesn't cut it. We need a better conversation about the latest biggest election of our lives. On Pod Save America, me and my co-host cut through the noise to help you figure out what matters and how you can help. Every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday, Pod Save America is breaking down the political news that makes us laugh, cry, and snap our laptops in half. Expensive year for laptops. Make sure to check out new episodes of Pod Save America on your favorite podcast platform or our YouTube channel now.
And now let's go to cocktail chatter. When you are having a cocktail, perhaps alone in the treaty room at night, in the treaty room of the Dickerson Mansion at night, John, what will you be chattering about to the person who is or is not with you in that room, to President Grant on the wall?
So I have a double-barreled chatter, which is the first is just The Night Manager, the miniseries with Tom Hiddleston and Hugh Laurie. I'm halfway through watching it, and I love it. It's great. I almost never get a chance to watch TV, and I'm mid-binge through this and really enjoying it. And then the second thing is about me, because there's only a month before the book comes out, the Whistle Stop book. August 2nd, it will come out. And those of you in New York City who are near the City Winery can come to a live Whistle Stop with me. Tickets went on sale today at slate.com/live. Sign up for the show, 7:30, and it'll be a live Whistle Stop performance of a kind that was immediately, intuitively understood by Emily Bazelon, which made me feel great when I gave her my pitch for how I was going to do it, because Anne was like, huh? Anyway, so you can come.
I think you talked to me about this, but I'm not going to be in
you
town, but
I wanted to have
a part
reaction
in it.
Yeah, nice I know. Try. Well, you might have a part in the one when we do it in town, whenever that is in Washington. There are going to be others in...
Better let me have a part.
Yeah, well, the New York one is the first one. There will be others in other cities, depending A, on interest, and B, on travel and that kind of thing. But yeah, and then we're going to find a way to do one where you guys play a role. I really want to find you a role for you to play in the inquiry into the Mulligan letters, which is my favorite little drama about James Blaine and Mr. Mulligan. But anyway, New York, I hope to see you there, all of you who have pre-ordered the book, or those of you who are now inspired to pre-order the book, or those who just want to get the book when they come to the show.
Emily, what's your chatter?
My chatter is about a book that I have been dying to recommend since I read it a couple of months ago, and it is now about to be published. It's called Break in Case of Emergency. It's by our wonderful Slate colleague, Jessica Winter. It is like the female foundation version of the TV show Silicon Valley, a totally hilarious parody of the world of foundations and nonprofits, which women dominate, but not necessarily to anyone's good, including their own. It's a world that has a lot of celebrity bullshit in it, which Jessica just does an expert job of dissecting. And it also has a very winning character at the center. The main character is working at a kind of phony foundation, but she's a real person herself. I just think this book, it's so much fun to read. Such a good beach read. Has something to say, but is also just light and biting and funny. So again, it's called Break in Case of Emergency by Jessica Winter, and you can order it now on Amazon. I think it will appear next week.
It is awesome. Jessica can write her ass off.
Really,
the
right?
Sentences are incredible.
Yes, she really brings it. It's super fun.
Well, if we talk about log rolling, the triple book log rolling.
We could like get a cabin out of all of these logs.
People are going to have a library by the time they're done.
I was
today,
not log rolling.
Show.
I did not feel that. I was genuinely
well,
offering
I'm about
an
to log roll. Can you
maybe
let me
just kindling or something?
Can I? I have a very heartfelt, like needy chatter today, which is that speaking of books, the Atlas Obscura book is also coming out, and it's called Atlas Obscura, An Explorer's Guide to the World's Hidden Wonders. It is absolutely fantastic. I can say that because I actually had nothing to do with its creation. It predated me in Atlas Obscura.
Plus, it really is very fantastic having...
It's fantastic, and I noticed it's number one in whatever category.
It's a beautiful book, which is all about the strange and curious and wondrous places in the world, like the Waitomo glowworm caves in New Zealand, which are lit by these luminous worms, or the secret apartment at the top of the Eiffel Tower that you never knew about. I want to beg and urge you to pre-order this book. It will help my life. It will make my life better, and you will get the best present for yourself or for someone else that you can imagine. So if you go to atlasobscura.com/book, you can pre-order there and get a beautiful enamel pin, or just go to Amazon. The book is only $21. It's 500 pages. It's only $21. And it's just, it's going to be the best $21 you spend this year. So I would...
You may spend $21 on another book that might feel equally
powerful.
You had your chance.
No,
it works perfectly. I'm in August, you're in September. Go order this book.
Go pre-order all these books.
Welcome to the Month Club. Yes. July. Good idea.
Okay. So thanks for listening to the show this week. Can we urge you to please leave a comment in iTunes and a rating if you haven't? It really helps the show. You've listened this far. It means you are a fan. You probably have a strong opinion. Comments signal to iTunes that, hey, this is a show that you're interested in. You know, sometimes it's a flashy new show that gets lots of comments, but we'd love for your comments about the GabFest to be there. And it would really help us if you leave a comment in the iTunes store about the GabFest. So you can go to subscribe there and search for Slate Political GabFest in the iTunes store and leave that comment and rating. Our intern is Kevin Townsend. Our producer is Jocelyn Frank. Steve Lichtai is the executive producer of Slate Podcasts. Andy Bowers is the chief content officer for Panoply. Check out the entire roster of Panoply shows at itunes.com/Panoply. Our show page is slate.com/GabFest. Our Facebook page is facebook.com/GabFest. Our Twitter feed is @SlateGabFest. And our email address is gabfest@slate.com. For Emily Bazelon and John Dickerson, I'm David Plotz. We will see many of you in Washington at our live show at the Warner Theater next week. Slate.com/live to get tickets. There's still some available. Hope to see you there.
I'm Dahlia Lithwick, and I'm host of Amicus, Slate's podcast about the law and the U.S. Supreme Court. We are shifting into high gear, coming at you weekly with the context you need to understand the rapidly changing legal landscape. The many trials of Donald J. Trump, judicial ethics, arguments and opinions at SCOTUS. We are tackling the big legal news with clarity and insight every single week. New Amicus episodes every Saturday, wherever you listen.